You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
We thought that we would have this, the brown bag is a conversation rather than any formal presentations. And so I thought I would begin by maybe just turning first to Michael and Peter. And asking them, very basically, what is different today about propaganda as you read and interpret it, coming from the Russian context? Is there anything fundamentally different between disinformation today and disinformation from yesterday?
Should I do my little thing first? And you, we've been around the world doing this, so we're gonna, I'm actually going to talk about something else today, because. I think the argument's moving on quite rapidly. I think that there's, one has to do is take a step back and see it within the context of Russia's grand strategy. So since around 2004, their military thinking has been obsessed with the idea of asymmetric war. I mean, it's actually something they wrote about in the Soviet times already. But the idea of asymmetric war is essentially Russia is weaker than the West. It can't take the West on militarily, so therefore it has to use the openness of the West, the weaknesses of the West against itself. It's sort of a more covert approach to war. And the three, among the many things they focus on is information. They also focus on money, they focus on sort of civil society as a way to exploit the West. So this is actually embedded in a whole strategy, which is in itself embedded in a worldview, which is a sort of a vestige of dialectic. They still see the military elites and the hawkish side of Russia still see the world as essentially a place of great powers endlessly competing and forever competing. So it's actually that there is a worldview behind it, and that has become essentially very... The military people have been writing about this since the mid-2000s, but now it's sort of become mainstream, and now you hear journalists talking about it, you hear Putin talking about it, you hear, people who used to be quite friendly in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs are very westernized talking about it. So that's kind of the first thing to understand. This is part of a much broader strategy. In terms of the disinformation and what we think of as, we talk about as propaganda, I think there are three main topics to approach. One is they've made it incredibly entertaining. I think that's sort of the obvious one. So I had the surreal pleasure of working inside Russia's entertainment TV in the mid-2000s. I've just written a book about it. Available at all good bookstores.
I'm going to highlight that later.
Okay. So they made it incredibly entertaining. And in that sense, why is that so important? They've mixed sort of Western entertainment with Soviet ideas of psychological manipulation. Why is that important? Because it actually really undermines the old Western narratives. If the old Western narrative in the Cold War was we combine sort of Levi's jeans, parliamentary democracy, Mercedes Benzes and merchant banking into one great story that combines sort of democracy and hedonism. Now they've said you can have merchant banking, Mercedes, reality shows, MTV, Taylor Swift, and worship Putin and hate America. So they've completely sort of sliced into little bits the Western idea, repackaged it and spat it back in our faces. There was one moment which really pointed out to what extent some people here don't grasp that. There was an op-ed in the New York Times by one of their senior writers saying Ukraine will, at the end of the day, join the West because they listen to Taylor Swift. I mean, this completely doesn't get the way the whole ideological formula has been reprogrammed. The second thing they do is really something, not so much information war, but an attack on information. So spewing out conspiracy theories, spewing out disinformation. Most obvious example, MH17, Russian media is doing a million and one conspiracy theories, creating fake Twitter accounts to create a conspiracy onto it, and just flooding the information space so people just go, oh, what's the truth anyway? So that's really a war on information. That's a war, in the memorable words of one of my editors at The Guardian, Jonathan Shannon, who I think is a friend of yours, a terrorist attack on the infrastructure of reason, which I thought was very beautifully put. The third thing, though, is really something which is not about ideology, it's not about semiotics, it's not about any of these things. It's it's about military intelligence operations done through broadcasting arms. So in Soviet Union, it was called Active Measures. So there was a huge department of Active Measures whose aim was to pollute opinion-making, divide the West. And they would do operations back then, like, saying that the CIA began the AIDS virus as a weapon against the Afro-American population. And they tried to put that in a Western newspaper. Now this is sort of done massively openly, and the internet is the sort of ideal sort of place for this. So these are really kind of military intelligence operations which are pushed through the veneer of broadcasting. I expect that this is actually how they justify the massive budgets of RT to Putin, because it's something Putin understands. Maybe we should start looking at some of the Russian broadcasting agencies, not even as propaganda as such, not about persuasion or PR or spin, but really in military terms as tools to demoralize, act as decoys and so forth. That's certainly the way Russian military thinking writes about these things. You know, that's what they, when they're talking about information war, they're not talking about spin or creating a better image. They're talking about weapons, essentially. So it's weaponized information. That's the title of our report. So I think those are the main three things, but it's very important to understand the intellectual background and the overall strategy. I mean, we over-focus on RT. RT is a decoy, essentially. In Britain, RT is a decoy. They want to get banned by the regulator, I'm pretty sure of that. Or they want to definitely draw fire from the regulator to sort of make themselves look good, to get more attention. The real influence is often happening through financial elites. So all these op-eds about RT, I've just written one this morning for the New York Times. I kind of regret writing it at the same time, because don't look at RT. That's really the shiny thing over here. The bad, the really sort of insidious stuff is happening in other places.
Okay, Peter, just for those of you who are not following the... Russian politics? No, we're just talking about RT, of course, refers to Russia Today, which is a Russian state-funded television organ that has stations now, and I don't know how many countries broadcast Russia Today. Rabab, I'd love to just immediately put Peter's postulates on Russian disinformation in the Egyptian context, in terms of the conspiracy theories, in terms of the entertainment, in terms of the militarization, the Department of Moral Affairs, mm-hmm. is it, within the military? Is that conjunction for the propagation of disinformation any similar to what Peter was discussing? Does it resonate in the Egyptian context?
Absolutely. I mean, lots of similarities. But as opposed to the idea of this being a conspiracy theory where people sit in a room and decide, so the narrative will be, the anti-revolution narrative will be X, Y, and Z, we see sort of orchestrated efforts from different establishments and different interest groups without this necessarily being part of a conspiracy. It's just the sort of the, interests aligned one way or the other. So, and that narrative is not particularly just some kind of discourse that's fleeting out there, but it's actually a condensification and a reflection of power dynamics on the ground. So we see that narrative, for example, that equates revolution and uprising with chaos, that equates Egyptianness with the respect for the military, that detaches the idea of the state from the citizens. So Egypt is about the state, about Hibt al-Dawla, and that's what makes you a good Egyptian, not that you respect yourself or respect others in society, but you respect the state, so to speak. That detachment, the demonization of all Islamists. They're all terrorists, they're all a counter threat, they're all non-Egyptians. And capitalizing on historical symbolism of colonialism and the post-colonial struggle to build that narrative, that doesn't just becomes a discourse where those kinds of symbols and historical references are used in the media, but rather we see that the media is working in harmony with the judiciary, the security, and the businessmen. I'll explain in a second how this happens, but the idea that needs to be completely dismissed in Egypt, and you guys can tell me if that's the case, the same thing in Russia, is the whole idea of a public-private divide within the media, right? The idea was always that, of course, during the Nasserite era or earlier, nationalist eras when everything was publicly owned, that's how propaganda and indoctrination happened. But once you have, a free market, media establishment kind of thing, that doesn't necessarily happen. Absolutely not. we see that the private establishments, the private media establishments, which are much more heard now than the nationalist TV, work in tandem with what the state and the military specifically puts forward. And this has two clear reasons. One is that all those business people are part of that crony capitalism where their interests outside of the media is clearly tied to the red taping, the regulation, everything that the state does. And accordingly, they feed into whatever narrative the state wants without even getting direct orders from الشؤون المعنوية, from the Department of Moral Affairs. So, of course, they give them the grand guidelines, you know, about who they should have on TV, what kind of music they should put on, but they don't, it's not that kind of 1984 construct where they're following day to day. But rather, those private establishments have every interest to feed into this
and
propaganda.
Rabat, how much of what you describe right now is post-Morsi?
Oh, it's not just post-Morsi. I think a huge part of the mobilization... So the mobilization against Morsi was very real. Morsi had tremendous mistakes, absolutely. But actually the narrative that was created for the anti-Morsi mobilization wasn't for what in my mind are Morsi's and the Brotherhood mistakes. But it was a twist. So certain legendary things that are completely irrational, like Morsi is gonna sell Sinai for $20 billion to the Palestinians. That became sort of, you know, like an urban legend that everyone believes, including people with PhDs. So university professors are talking about this, and you're like, no, that could not have been the case. There are other problems. Before the June 30th, we know that there were certain TV presenters and commentators, including someone like Heikal, for example, who actually rescheduled their holidays so that they're there, you know, mobilized. I went down on the 30th, and everything that I heard from the hundreds of thousands or millions who were there was actually things that they did not experience firsthand, but things that they heard through the media. My final point, though, is that those things they hear in the media are not just created lies or stories. They become substantiated by sentences from the judiciary, and hence it becomes, you know, yes, of course, they are all terrorists, and that's why we see more than 600 being convicted and, you know, on death sentence. And they're also substantiated by the security establishment, not just through leads that are given, but through creating that threat, sort of the Michael Moore kind of thing, where every time there's a bomb going off somewhere, which you see on the media all the time, are the policemen being killed, either in Cairo or in Sinai. So all this stops people from questioning to what extent this is just, you know, lip service or talk, as opposed to, you know, that is the quote-unquote real story.
So taking, Rabab, what you just noted, maybe I turn now to Michael to see how much of this resonates back in the Russian sphere, the sort of intersectorality that Rabab talks about, where justice, interior, business are all part of a kind of broader dissemination strategy, yeah, and the way in which lies are sort of instantiated into reality.
Well, I think the disconnect is that in Russia, there really is no private-public separation anymore. I mean, one of Putin's first acts as president was to sort of nationalize the main source of media, which was television. So, you know, you have this giant, this vast state media apparatus, which is where most Russians get their news. And, you know, as Peter, I think, mentioned, it's not necessarily about propounding one narrative or one theory or thesis about, you know, whatever event. It's about sort of throwing sand in the air, discombobulation, confusion, sowing skepticism, sowing doubt. I think the trick is, you know, Russia is much more fundamentally interested in the West's notion of itself and the West's notion of Russia. So they like to use our strengths as weaknesses. They actually turn our strengths into weaknesses. So, you know, quite rightly, Peter said, RT is not really the issue, that's the decoy. The issue to me is how Russia manages to massage or manipulate the American and the European news cycles. To give you some very concrete examples, obviously, Putin has a relationship with Bashar al-Assad in Syria and has been doing a lot of the diplomatic water carrying for the Syrian regime. So when the chemical weapons attacks in Ghouta in August of 2013 were perpetrated, Russia's immediate response was to say either this didn't happen, it was staged, or it did happen, but the rebels did it. They gassed themselves. And one of the earliest sort of more absurd and imaginative conspiracy theories that was propagated, Alexander Lukashevich, who's the spokesman for the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, came out and said, aha, we can prove that this whole thing was a frame-up, because the YouTube video showing the first purported victims of the attack had been uploaded to YouTube before the alleged attack took place. Now, the thing there was that YouTube runs on California time, not on Damascus time. So the Russian Foreign Ministry didn't know the Earth goes around the sun and was trying to kind of pull a fast one. But honestly, this made it into, I think, the BBC and several other media outlets. And, you know, of course, they tried to dress it up as, oh, well, you know, we can't quite be sure as to what Mr. Lukashevich means or is saying here. But it doesn't matter. When all you do is look at headlines, and what in the UK they call the stand first, which is the subhead, and they read, like, you know, Russia, colon, or Putin, colon, the West does this, or, you know, Russia, rebels gas cells in Syria. Eventually, this has this takes a sort of psychological toll. Now, we can sit around the room and say, well, no, this is all just kind of farcical, nobody believes this stuff. But actually, no, quite a few people do believe this stuff. You know, in the United States, there was a poll conducted several years ago that found that actually a larger percentage of people think that 9/11 was an inside job than we would be probably comfortable admitting to ourselves. Russia exploits this. They use that. Conspiracy theories occur spontaneously in nature. Crankdom, sort of, you know, deranged people sitting in their parents' basement coming up with manifestos about, you know, how the Illuminati and Freemasons rule the world. These people occur freely in nature. The trick is Russia finds them very easily and very cheaply, and weaponizes them, turns them into kind of agents of a vast media campaign. So, you know, Peter mentioned active measures, I think, or maybe you didn't mention that. Yeah, active measures in the 1970s was a sort of KGB construct. Essentially, the idea was to plant pieces of disinformation, completely cooked up stories in the Western news cycle, in the hopes that this would divide particularly the alliance between the United States and its NATO allies in Europe, but also just weaken and again try to create a kind of intellectual fifth column, if you like, within the West. The difficulty was in the 70s, I mean, we're talking the dead tree press era, right? So active measures, the most famous example of an active measure. The KGB planted a story in an Italian newspaper after JFK was killed. So actually, it didn't begin in the 70s, it began a bit earlier than that, suggesting that the CIA offed the American president. This story wended its way into, I think it was the New Orleans prosecutor's office, and was actually taken up by American investigators. If you've seen the Oliver Stone film JFK, it's discussed at length in there. Oliver Stone, I'm pretty sure, doesn't realize that this was a whole KGB fabrication, or if he does, he doesn't care. But the point is, it took a great deal of effort to get that, you know, accomplished, to get that mission to be successful. Today, what is an active measure? Well, as I say, an active measure is a guy sitting in his parents' basement saying, right, so the Pope is a space alien. True story, by the way, that's an RT story. The CIA invented the Ebola virus as a form of biological warfare, also a true story, which was actually first published in RT's Spanish language edition, catering to a Latin American conceptions about, you know, U.S. intelligence and nefarious operations that had been conducted in South and Central America. And they just get these people to write this stuff, and within the space of 5-15 minutes, you have an active measure, you know, from top to bottom, which can then go viral, as we say on the internet. You know, everyone can read it. It can get a lot of clicks. It can generate a lot of attention. And again, the goal isn't necessarily to persuade people this is the truth. You know, Russia's insight into sort of, you know, Western intellectual and moral conceit of the last, I would say, the post-war period, is that there is no such thing as truth. It's all relative, right? What is fact? There is no such thing as objectivity. All media organizations lie. Look at the New York Times and WMD in Iraq. You know, that's just what we do. You know, everything is subjective, so why can't we have our say? So they like to inject this sort of the alternative explanation or the alternative viewpoint. And in doing so, all you have to do is create doubt or second guessing. So people start to wonder about their own government's policies. The kind of Rosetta Stone of this, I would say, again, coming back to the Syrian chemical weapons affair, right after that, or several weeks after that, Vladimir Putin published a piece in the New York Times. You all remember that, right? So consider this sort of context. That piece was actually placed by a Western public relations firm. Itself, just as a bit of kind of meta-analysis, you know, that the Kremlin could hire a Western company to publish a piece of propaganda in the major American broadsheet bespeaks volumes about, you know, Western cynicism and how everybody can be bought, everyone can be co-opted. Right? So that's part one. Part two, the piece was published on September 11, 2013. So incredibly redolent of America's foreign policy adventurism and its follies abroad in the wake of the attack on the World Trade Center. And then three, the piece was, America, don't get involved in Syria, listen to me, I had it right on Iraq, I had it right on Libya, you didn't listen to me, and this is why you're in quagmires throughout the region. Oh, and by the way, the rebels gassed themselves. So a kind of trifecta of active measure. And again, using not some conspiratorial, you know, news agency or, you know, kind of crankish conduit to, but using the Gray Lady, using the New York Times to do it.
So, Peter, let me ask this, because I think it would be useful before we open it up to talk a little bit about what might be done in any form to counteract what's transpiring. I see in Europe today what some people might submit are very respectable political parties, say Podemos in Spain, that might become in 2015 in the parliamentary elections the largest party in Spain that exists as of January of this year, run by university intellectuals who are saying that the Ukrainian government is a neo-fascist, thuggish, junta, whatever, fascist government. How do you contend with the sort of profound misconceptions of a party led by university intellectuals about a country on their continent for which they can get readily accessible information, what's actually transpiring? It can't be, as I think, Peter, you rightly point out, it can't just be the fact that, you know, the head of Podemos is watching RT before he goes to sleep, right? I would assume that there are other factors at play that you thoughtfully delineate. But what does one do? And we actually had this conversation at the global board meeting in Budapest last week, the OSF global board meeting. One suggestion that I had, and I'd be curious if you think this is fanciful, is to say, to bring people from Podemos to Kiev, to introduce them to their 28 new parliamentarians who come from the world of journalism, think tanks and the like. I would say not one of them has a fascist bone in their body, as far as I could tell. Very respectable people. And to sit down with these new parliamentarians in Kiev and to talk about politics. They're all new political party members, activists. The thing I'm really getting at is that we at the Open Society Foundations come into contact with those who want to fund huge, enormous, very expensive counter-propaganda projects. So the USAIDs, the Khodorkovskys, who want us to go in and spend $100 million to have a counter-narrative, whatever that actually means. What is to be done, Peter, in this sense?
I do think we have to break down the problem into its various sort of theatres and audiences. I mean, the biggest what is to be done is what is to be done inside of Russia. The second biggest what is to be done is the Russian speakers in the near abroad. I mean, they're, you know, today we talk about RT a lot and stuff in the West, but listen, we're really the sideshow here. The real crisis, the existential crisis is there. That's where our look has to be. So that's sort of Russian speakers in Ukraine, Latvia, Estonia, the 4.5 million in Germany. For those three things that I talked about, you kind of need slightly different responses. For the entertainment stuff, I mean, it's a case of getting their attention back, because they are actually watching Russian TV. So to get their attention back and to get them believing in a slightly different sort of code of values, we do actually need, I wouldn't call it counter propaganda, I just call it good television and good media for them. At the moment, they're just watching Kremlin stuff. I was in Riga the other week, which is the capital of Latvia. I'm sure you know that. And I flicked through the TV, and terrible Latvian channels, really bad, like 1970s German TV, like bad. And then you get to the Russian channels, bright, entertaining. America and the Masons are at war with us, but like in a really great way. And so it's actually about making the sort of TV that would get them back. I'm a TV producer. I could go into sort of the details of what sort of programming would need to be done. And yes, we would need to spend hundreds of millions. And until we have, we're going to lose them. We're going to be in a lot of trouble. The shocking thing for me is when you go to Latvia and Estonia, they're like, where's the money? Like, this is your existential crisis. Where's the money? That was off the record. The Estonians less, the Latvians particularly bad. But the same thing in Ukraine. So yes, we will have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, and that is very, very cheap compared to having to spend money on tanks in a real war. So at the moment, while it's still an information sort of contest, we can get it back. But in the West, where it is a much more nuanced game, I think the clever thing the Kremlin's done is that it looks at every place very, very kind of like concretely. So in Serbia, they'll have one tactic. In Croatia, a completely other information tactic. In Britain, they'll have a third one. So we almost have to get as sort of micro level back. So I just don't know what the exact context is in Greece and why Podemos are saying this. But I think it's all
Spain.
About...
Syriza said the same thing in Greece, though.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no.
In Spain. Is it just financial ties? Usually it is. I mean, Anton Chekhovtsov, who's the best researcher about the connections between Russia and the far right, say... It looks like an ideological thing. It's actually a corruption thing, usually. So, you know, the French far rights are getting great business deals in Russia. They're getting they're getting 40 million worth of funding from a Russian bank. So the hit back would be corruption. You know, it wouldn't be to answer them ideologically. But hold on, where's this money coming from?
But the leverage, if we just talk about the United States for a second, the leverage that the U.S. has over Russia is minimal, but in the Egypt case, of course, the leverage is potentially great at whatever it is, $2.5-3 billion a year. Is there anything that the U.S., assuming that the U.S. had a value-based foreign policy, let's just so if we had that as an assumption, would there be any opportunities for the U.S. to do something to counteract what's happening in Egypt on any front that would contend with disinformation, let alone the broader political environment?
Let's talk about the OSF, not the Americans, because I don't think
okay.
that... No, Lenny, I disagree, actually, with both you and Peter, to an extent. I don't think that a counter-narrative can just happen or be productive. I think narratives are reflections of forms of domination and power structures and things on the ground. It's not just creating the right messages and branding. I think this was one of the key problems of our uprising. We thought that saying, you know, making the moral argument, saying the right story, you know, showing people that this works, and it doesn't. Quick story. Right after the uprising and for a year to follow, a number of independent media people and activists tried to put together one independent channel that would not be funded, in particular by one business firm. But that channel that wouldn't be under the hegemony or control of one particular firm, person, or the state, even though it was supported by people who had big names and some that had the money, did not see the light. And mm-hmm. why didn't it see the light? Not just because security, at that time, security seemed to have ceased to exist. They didn't stop us through not giving the right permissions or whatnot, but through so many dynamics that I don't have to get into. I was just talking to a friend about it, you know, from having people attend the meetings and, you know, being very destructive of the whole idea, to making it very difficult to go through the bureaucracy and so many things. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, plus, I mean, one of the things that happened during the lead up to the mobilization against Morsi is that they didn't get the fulul. They didn't get old faces from the establishment, from the ancien regime, to talk against Morsi. They actually brought us on TV. Mm-hmm. And they asked the questions that, because we were critical of Morsi, mm-hmm. but then this discourse was tailored within a bigger narrative whereby, you know, people were being held up in the street, power dynamics using institutions that we have no control on. So no matter how much, establishments, whether it's OSF or USAID, or spend in terms of creating the right image about, dictatorship, or that doesn't work in a vacuum. That you need to have political groups who are establishing a different narrative, procedure, and political practice. You need to demilitarize the public space so that people can question and talk instead of the continuous hammering happening in schools, in the media. So it's just a
so bigger. Just on that point, just to bring it back to Peter and Michael, because I actually, Rabah, very much agree with you. The idea of some set of ideas in the abstract, being able to push forward a new narrative, not sort of grounded in the material and the political, I agree is quite potentially a recipe for disaster. But then in the Russian context, does that mean our focus must be for all the difficulties exist with the so-called opposition? Does it have to be on the ground realities, working as we do for years with civil society actors, the kind of meat and potatoes of open society work, and to stay away from this kind of more Marx, less Hegel, stay away from the big idea, and really continue to focus on what we've been doing for years in building institutions and the like, and having a much more long-term strategy.
Yeah, why are these things mutually contradictory? I don't know. We're just talking about disinformation today. No, again, it's different with the Russians because there's the problem inside of Russia where we maybe need to be preparing for a disaster very soon and hoping 91 doesn't happen again. That could be the strategy for Russia. And we're talking, and the other audience is Russians in Ukraine, Moldova. That's what's at stake, really. I completely agree. I mean, the Latvians don't just have to make TV for the Russians in Latvia. They have to have NGOs and a better, a more inclusive school system. No, they've done everything wrong, I think, often on purpose. And now they're bearing the fruits of their, I think, very stupid or lack of any integration policy. I completely agree it has too many layers. I'm just a TV producer. I make shows. We certainly don't think of narratives quite so naively, though. We are actually talking about the semiotic building blocks of getting people to think in not getting them to think, but encouraging critical thinking. At the end of the day, what the Russians are doing, it sounds very similar in Egypt, is destroying critical thought, quite on purpose in their television. Yeah. It works like a sect. Conspiracies to confuse you, traumas, 1990s Stalin period, to get you emotionally conflicted, Putin at the end to raise you up. It's structured exactly like a sect. You have to work for them like people in a sect and try to get them to start thinking critically again. That's actually quite cunning and clever, television. Is it a reflection of hegemonic narrative? Well, God bless the hegemonic narrative.
And it should surprise no one that a party led by university professors or intellectuals is sort of succumbing to this idea that, Ukraine is run by anti-Semitic Nazis, right? I mean, look, the Kremlin's real trick, and I think they're genius in the way that they perpetrate this, is what can the U.S. say? We stand for democracy and human rights and open society. And all they have to do is point to Occupy Wall Street or some, huge corruption scandal that's rocking the American or the European establishment. There was a great essay in London Review of Books by actually talking of coming back to Marx instead of Hegel by Perry Anderson. Not somebody I necessarily agree with all the time, but, it had nothing to do with Russia. It was all to do with the European Union. And he went country by country, showing just the kind of giving the context and the nature of each scandal and the enormity of each scandal and how kind of this grand idea of the United States of Europe and this was going to put an end to warfare and going to liberalize the economy throughout the continent. The whole thing was bullshit, and it kind of all came crumbling down. People living in these countries see for themselves. They don't need to be told by Russia that their own house is in disarray. They see for themselves that, their politicians are corrupt, the economy is crap, rampant unemployment. This is why you're seeing now the proliferation of far-right and indeed far-left political parties in Greece, in Spain, in Hungary. Ironically, in Ukraine, it was the one country where I think these parties, the fringe elements, were mostly repudiated by the last parliamentary election. But I don't necessarily think, a counter-narrative to me just sounds like propaganda from the other side, right? I mean, what's the point? My sort of modus operandi or the way I see waging a sort of, defense campaign, if you like, or even an offense campaign, is to say, what actually is the Putinist system's main vulnerability? What's its Achilles heel? And the one thing I noticed in the last few years is, you know, they assume that everyone knows they're corrupt and that they steal from their own people. But they like to kind of modulate the perception of just how corrupt they are, you know, within certain limits, right? So when it reaches a saturation point and, you know, the main political party in Russia is known universally as the party of crooks and thieves, that becomes a problem because then 100,000 people turn out on the streets of Moscow. And then Putin says, uh-oh, this looks a lot to me like 2004 in Kyiv, right? Or indeed 2014 in Kyiv. So, you know, and I also noticed, you know, unlike, say, Egypt, maybe I'm wrong about this, where there tends to be more of a kind of monolithic, I mean, the military is the most kind of... In Russia, you have these various factions, rivalrous, competitive factions, Siloviki. They hate each other. There's no broad agreement. I mean, Putin is sort of, you know, he's like, you know, somebody, you know, moderating a playpen or a nursery, you know? And when you focus on the internal corruption, just how much money has been stolen, the hypocrisy, they hate Europe, they hate the, or they don't hate Europe, but they kind of go on about the cynicism and the illiberalism and the non-democratic nature of Europe, and yet they put all their money there, right? They want to live la dolce vita. They want to shop on Madison Avenue, or they want to shop at Harrods in London and buy up, you know, palatial real estate in Surrey or whatever. When you focus on that, what's interesting is even within the system, the Russian media pays attention to this stuff because there's one faction that's now being exposed and vitiated to the benefit of another faction. So you sort of set the cat among the pigeons. There's a self-cannibalization process that takes effect. And let's be honest, to me, I mean, you know, Russia's, Transparency International ranks Russia's on par with Nigeria in terms of, you know, its economic transparency. And one third of its GDP is frittered away through bribery, according to an independent monitoring organization. When you make the story about just how much money has been stolen, where does it go, what are the conduits and the channels it travels through in terms of money laundering, where does it wind up in Europe, what European politicians, as Peter alluded to, are in the Kremlin's pocket as a result of it, all of a sudden people stop paying attention to nonsense and they start paying attention to the big story. The New York Times had a huge full-bore investigative piece on Bankrosia several months ago at this rate. It was great. Reuters has been doing a 3 or 4 or 5 part series called Comrade Capitalism on where all the money is going. And every single story involves, you know, the sort of leitmotif of it is we have to get our own house in order because you have European companies, you have American companies that are essentially on the take. You know, I noticed that the pushback to our report, the most ferocious pushback, mm-hmm. is coming from people who have, you know, former, in their CV, they used to work for J.P. Morgan, or they're investment bankers, or they're anti-sanctions, not because they think sanctions are ineffective, but because it means they're going to lose money, right?
Can we just talk about, just quickly, on the pushback question, you guys, along with several others, like Ann Applebaum, who you may know as a columnist for the Washington Post. She actually has a review of Karen Deutsch's book on Putin in the recent New York Review of Each Other's Books. You guys, with Anne, with Ben Judah, have been branded as CIA flunkies, you know, right-wing toadies of the U.S. establishment, friends of John McCain. Misha Saakashvili.
I haven't got any of that yet. He gets that.
I get it all.
Well,
I get that.
Okay, but that's maybe for your larger corpus of work, Michael. But in any case,
I don't even get Jewish.
Kamaransky doesn't necessarily.
Right, but no, sure. But Peter, you were included in tweets directed at me that said specifically, "Why are you funding Lenny the Carnegie Corporation, Carnegie Moscow Center? Why are you funding Johnson's List?" Right? So I got caught up in the mishigas that you guys helped inspire. So my question, I'm curious to hear from you about that level of the sort of political debate. Where is it coming from the corporate sector? Where is it coming from?
Well, in that case, I think I'm the one who stirred the pot a bit on that, I'm afraid, Lenny. But no, look, you know, it depends. I think for a while, you know, up until about 2004, 1905-ish. The first apogee of this was, of course, the Georgian War in 2008. But the idea was, yeah, you know, Putin, he's sort of a cold-hearted KGB man, but, you know, the economy's doing okay. He's sort of kind of pretending to work with us in the war on terror, even though he leveled Grozny. That's his form of counterinsurgency. So let's just leave him alone, and everything is sort of a kind of, you know, tranquil waters sort of thing. Ukraine has now demolished that myth, right? I mean, that you can see it in the kind of the high anxiety, the paranoia, the sort of febrile reaction of people, such as our friend Mr. Johnson and what he chooses to syndicate. People are going nuts about this because they think, oh, you know, it's once again, it's this descent into sort of Western Russophobia, and it's this sort of Manichaean narrative of good versus evil and blah, 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 blah. Look, the bottom line is Russia has invaded and annexed European territory. Russia is waging a dirty, nasty war, which has resulted in acts of international terrorism against civilians on a commercial airliner in the eastern part of our country, undeclared. Russia is losing its own soldiers who are being buried in secret because, again, it's an undeclared war. I mean, this is a sort of basic thing that the average man in the street can say, right, that's naughty boy, that's bad behavior, they shouldn't be doing that. And the war in Iraq doesn't justify it, and, you know, what America did in Latin America in the 80s doesn't justify it and all that. It's just, let's take this case as it is. Instead, it's this attempt to kind of distract us from what Russia is up to. It's all about, you know, whataboutism. It's all about moral equivalence. It's all about, well, you know, you do this and blah, blah, blah. No, keep the focus on Ukraine. I think the greatest rebuttal to Putin and the greatest sort of, if you like, counter-disinformation or counter-narrative, although I'm loath to use that term, is to make Ukraine a success story, right? Empower the people of Ukraine. I Open Society is looking for people who are doing this sort of great. They exist in Ukraine. TV Gromadsky, Stop Fake, all of these organizations, the civil society in Ukraine, again, I mean, has it well over the Poroshenko government in terms of competence, in terms of intellectual and moral clarity, and in terms of passion. And the work that they're doing, they are the heartbeat of the revolution. If Ukraine is allowed to have a free and independent media that criticizes its own government or calls its own government out for war crimes, or, you know, exposes rampant corruption, which is being embedded by the state, that is the ultimate, you know, FU to Mr. Putin, because that's exactly what he wants to stop. Ukraine is the kind of cockpit or the test case of what would happen in Russia in future.
And in fact, that is, in a nutshell, George Soros' argument.
So he's got it right then.
Can I ask something, actually? Now that we're on the subject of witch hunting. So I met with Stop Fake the other day, and I said,
Stop Fake
are a very dogged and myth-busting organization based in Kiev.
And a grantee of the Open Society Foundations.
They are?
Can you stop
they
the
are?
Promotion of for a minute now? The guy said one thing about his book and you...
They are or they aren't? Because they told me that you refused to fund them because it would be seen as taking sides.
No, IRF is now funding that.
Oh, you got over that bump. Well, I'm glad, because I was about to sort of like, you know, collar you about that. Listen, I think there's something perverse when people who work for huge Russian oligarchs embedded with Putin start accusing activists or self-starting journalists like Ben Judah or Michael of being the kind of the dangerous hegemonic force. And I'm sorry, I just find that ridiculous. You have people working for Alpha Bank and Morgan Stanley being funded by them, attacking Ben Judah, who lives with his parents and is just outraged that the city of London is becoming sort of, you know, a real liability for Britain. I don't know, it's just so funny and perverse.
Irrespective of whether Ben Judah lives with his parents or not.
Well, he does. You know, saving up for an apartment in Shepherd's Bush, for Christ's sake. Being attacked by... shall go unnamed. He's on an Alpha scholarship? I mean, are you kidding?
Okay, Peter, let's definitely turn to...
I mean, it's just so upside down.
To our colleagues. But since I sort of blurred OSF, we are in the belly of the beast, let me say that Peter's book came out last week?
November the 11th, which is almost last week.
Okay. Nothing is true and everything is possible. And I should say that Tina Brown, the illustrious former editor of the New Yorker magazine, says, I'm going to read Tina's quote, a riveting portrait of the new Russia, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't put it down. So do you want to put it up?
Hold on. Before we do the Tina attack, God, who are we picking on today? We're picking on Ben Judah and Tina Brown.
You know what's also interesting? In the blurbs for Peter's book, they spell his name three different ways.
A riveting portrait of the new Russia with all its corruption, willful power, and spasms of unforgettable poetic glamour. That's what Tina wrote. That's pretty close.
Okay, no, I very much look forward to reading Peter's book because he's a tremendous journalist. Let's turn now to colleagues for questions. It's 10 to 8? No. It's 1. It's 1. 20. It's 1. It's 1:20. So we have around half hour, 40 minutes. Justin Burke.
I'd like to get your take on how to is it possible to reach Russian audiences with from a Western perspective? And specifically, can and should we use humor, something like Jon Stewart, to sort of go asymmetrical on the Russian asymmetrical approach?
That's
just McCain saying that.
Yeah, that's the one thing we do leave out. You know, Ed Lucas is big on this, another friend of ours in the kind of vast neocon CIA conspiracy against Russia.
An economist. A journalist.
Yeah. It's for him, it's about satire and, you know, kind of. The one chink in that armor, I suppose, is that actually the Kremlin has a very good sense of humor. It has a kind of morbid, perverse. It's okay to poke fun at Putin within limits, right? So this would have to be done, I think, in a rather sophisticated way. But yeah, I mean, look, Navalny. I mean, his whole thing was using humor to expose sort of the thievery and the corruption, right? That's what made him popular.
An anti-corruption activist.
Yeah, sorry. I'm assuming that there's some base level of knowledge. I don't. If I'm saying something that nobody knows what I'm talking about, let me know. So yeah, I mean, like, you know, we did this thing at The Interpreter, which is the magazine I run, which, full disclosure, is funded by Mr. Khodorkovsky. We put that in our report. Thank you very much. You know, the ads that RT has, in case they shut us down and all that. Well, then when Russia booted CNN out of Moscow, we did one, in case they shut us down, go to CNN.com for the real story or whatever.
Did they really shut them down, or did they just leave?
Canceled their license. And
really?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, you know, these kinds of things, you know, trying to create sort of viral memes on the internet, I think, you know, they're not going to change the world. I'm not one of these sort of cyber utopians about it. But yeah, they can help kind of recalibrate, if you like, the kind of psychological understanding of what we're dealing with here. You know, there was a cartoon, I think it was in the Times of London. A lot of people thought this was really in poor taste and quite crude. I thought it was brilliant. And it was Putin standing there with his shirt off, another popular internet meme. And on the wall, you know, he had the head of a boar, the head of a bear, and then the front half of MH17. Now, a lot of people had exactly that reaction, and I thought, you know, no, that good on whoever the cartoonist was, because that's exactly the kind of message that ought to be sent. You know, this would not have happened but for this man and this dirty war that he is waging in East Ukraine. So absolutely, I mean, you know.
I like humor as well, but I think Michael makes a very important point that so in the Soviet Union, the Kremlin lost humor. So anecdotes were used as a form of cultural subversion. It's very aware that it won't make the same mistake now and makes very good satire programs within the country, which laugh at itself. I mean, like, there's a sketch show which is full of jokes about sort of corrupt Duma deputies going whoring, going, "We're going to get rid of Russia." You know, it's you know, so they've co-opted humour and made sure that it's part of their package. Actually, what their greatest Achilles heels are sort of a moral earnestness, because their idea is satirical. There is no such thing as values. You know, everything they do is a sort of a satire of the West to show it up. So I'm not sure you cannot satirize satirists. I mean, humor's great to get a message across or to get a fact across, but Navalny's great strength was that he named facts. Facts and earnestness is what they're scared of. It's when you start going, this bank account, bet this bank account, and you can do it in a jokey way, it's not dry. That's when they got scared of Navalny.
Can I just ask, in terms of the structures of power, your illustration of Putin with MH17. At the end of the day, as you yourself said, Michael, it's not just Putin, it's the structure of power. You talked about the seal of the key. So getting rid of Putin, and I'm curious, the same, getting rid of Sisi, it's the entire infrastructure of power that needs to be contended with at so many different levels that Putin, I'm not just saying that he's symptomatic or he's one small part of the equation. Of course, it's a very significant part. But we don't want to mislead ourselves in how we describe the problem,
sure.
And it's a very complex infrastructure.
Yeah, it's
power.
Not. I mean, regime decapitation is, you know, not the answer here, which is essentially what you had in
Egypt.
And you know, I will say this. You know, if I'm an agent of Langley, I'm not doing a very good job. The CIA takes a handful of journalists every so often and gives them a kind of briefing in Washington. And a friend of mine who shan't be named attended one of these recently. And the line was, we can't really get rid of Putin because what would come next would be so much worse. Mm. Which, you can take that at face value, you can believe that that's the case, or you can think that that's just a kind of extenuation of current U.S. policy. It's certainly an arguable position, but it tells you a lot. I mean, another thing we haven't touched on in this discussion, and again, I think the Russian government understands this sometimes better than we do, or we like to pretend it doesn't exist. There is a top-down nature to discourse in a democratic society. By that I mean, when the government sets a certain policy, everyone starts discussing, you know, the policy as a phenomenon and then all the epiphenomena of it. So, you know, the New York Times writes about Ukraine in such a way because of what the White House has decided is going to be the policy with respect to Ukraine. There's a journalist at the Times who told an official at the State Department, who then told me, State Department went to the Times and said, why do you guys keep referring to them as pro-Russian separatists? Most of these people, or a lot of them, are Russian separatists or Russian, you know, military intelligence officers or Russian soldiers. And the Timesman replied, well, if the President of the United States isn't saying that, why am I duty-bound to report it that way? So there is a kind of hierarchical nature to this. And I think, you know, depending on your perspective here, the good and the bad, you know, the next administration, I don't know if it's Hillary Clinton or if it's Jeb Bush or, I mean, even Rand Paul, for Christ's sakes, I think there's going to be a policy adjustment. I think there's going to be a much more confrontational line against the Russian state. And that will kind of precipitate. I mean, it's no coincidence that some of the best investigative journalism about Russian corruption has happened after Euromaidan, right? Where do you think these journalists are getting their information from? It's being leaked because the U.S. government wants to sort of shake things up. It wants to put Putin on notice a little bit, not completely. They're not disclosing everything they know. But he wants to sort of put his feet to the fire.
So there's nothing similar in the Egypt case.
Oh, I mean,
even Elizabeth Warren.
Of course. I mean, the lazy answers of that's a better alternative. You know, what we know is better than we don't know, which is, you know, the whole Mubarak thing. Mubarak followed by Morsi, and now with Sisi. In our case, the idea of the Islamic threat, so magnifying not only the ISIS threat, because that's pretty big, but equating everything with ISIS, so they're just different brands of the same thing. And those stands in binary and in opposition to everything that Sisi represents, which is absolutely not the case, because clearly they feed into each other. Clearly at the height of the revolution, we didn't see any kind of ISIS or even Al-Qaeda threats, because they are actually mutually exclusive. You either allow people to mobilize within, you know, civil society and express themselves, or you leave them hostage to just, you know, feeding or letting out that frustration within ISIS and whatnot. Again, Sisi, I believe, I always say, the idea is this country, Egypt, is being run like a big mafia. So there are different gangs out there. And at some point, those gangs agree that even though they might kill each other otherwise, they agree that it's the least common denominator, and the safest bet is to choose that representative. I'm not sure if you guys have been following, but 4 days ago, there were leaks coming out from the office of the chief of staff for Sisi, who was a big general. And it included the general prosecutor, the Minister of Security, and Ra'is al-Arkan, who I cannot think of what would be in English. So basically, what's like the chief of staff within the military? Like the second, the person that, you know, runs the show on the ground. Big thing. Anyways.
We're very civil society.
Oh, okay. Okay, whatever. And I'm so militarized, but not in translation.
We have the Joint Chiefs, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Yes, exactly. Right. Thank you. And basically, the leaks were taped. They weren't just phone. They were taped from the office of the personal assistant of Sisi, whereby the general prosecutor is saying that we need to forge some papers about the imprisonment of Morsi. He's calling the Minister of Security. A big thing whereby at some point of the leaks, the chief of staff says, don't worry, احنا في التزوير ملناش كبير. In forgery, no one can top us. Right? This is not the brotherhood, this is not opposition, this is not good activism. This is basically some kind of security apparatus being leaked because the CC 2 days earlier had said that he's thinking of issuing a decree, again very authoritarian, but a decree stopping people from demolishing the good name of the both revolutions, January and whatnot. So what we're seeing is also sort of frictions and fights within the establishment itself. But at some point, that head becomes a representation of some kind of common denominator. And I think what we need to look at is how do we, standing on the other side of the fence, how can we play out those kinds of differences, and how can we pragmatically, but also morally, use them out, not just to build a counter discourse, but to expose the kind of information that you guys were talking about.
And I should say, for those of you who are unable to glean it from Bob's words, but she is the model of the kind of engagé scholar involved both in the academy and in the opposition too. Can I ask one thing about the relationship with Israel? Is there, as far as you know, or do you have any empirical evidence about a relationship between Egypt and Israel with respect to propaganda vis-a-vis Turkey, vis-a-vis Palestine, Gaza in particular, vis-a-vis Iran, or is this...
No, I mean, we have certain facts that we know. I don't know what's within the black box. But listen to this. So Turkey was added last week to a list that only included Israel so far, whereby Egyptians between the age of 18 and 40 need to take a security permission before traveling to either of those countries. So equating Turkey with Israel being, historically speaking, the archetype of enemies, one. Two, the discourse, the general hegemonic narrative during the past Gaza war, whereby you have editorials in Al Ahram. Al Ahram is the state-owned, widest, oldest newspaper. An editorial saying, "Thank you, Netanyahu," because the real threat is Hamas, and Netanyahu is getting rid of Hamas, and hence, you know, we should be thankful. Equating all Palestinians and the Palestinian cause to the idea of Hamas, and Hamas being equated to the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood is ISIS and Daesh, and hence all Palestinians are terrorists by definition. The president, Sisi, using historical references all the time that actually... I got emotionally caught up, so that blames Palestinians for actually having sold their land, having led Egyptians to a number of unnecessary wars, and equating this with the kind of atrocities and colonial heritage of the Ottoman Empire, hence Turkey, and again, because he has that very religious Sunni Sufi element to his discourse and his being, that's also being put on the same par with the Iranians being Shiite. So what we're looking at here is actually a discourse as sectarian or even more sectarian and sometimes racist as that of the Muslim Brotherhood, but given both religious zeal and a nationalist twist. So you're actually being a good Muslim and a good Egyptian, Muslim being the big thing, of course, once you denounce the Palestinians, the Turkish, the Qataris, and then we're going to think about the Israelis later on.
Excellent. Thank you, Rabah. Yeah. So more comments or questions? Yeah, please, Elizabeth.
I wanted to go pick up on a thread that I think was here, which is about the asymmetry of tools that people who... aren't really who would want to think about restoring critical thinking have vis-a-vis operations like the Kremlin. So, and not to go into too much detail, but there are some grassroots organizations that are really interested in this question of, it's not quite a retreat, but it's sort of using the internet as a place to house how is a challenge to commonly accepted facts and rumors in the public sphere? So the rumor comes out that X, Y, and Z is true and has always been thus, and organizations or individual actors in this grassroots space try to gather the actual facts that either prove or disprove or nuance that point. And from my perspective, that seems like it has a lot of value. It's kind of expensive to support, but it does have value in producing producing a place where data and seeking out the facts and housing them for others to reuse becomes important. But that's responsive to some things that we can't really control. Like, I can't really control if a group that I think does do that kind of excellent rumor catching and counterbalancing gets picked up by the New York Times. So in that civil society space, what's the missing ingredient that might elevate that kind of fact-finding and data housing and data manipulation and really that catching the zeitgeist? Like, what do people actually care about? They might not care about how many people are in prison, but they might care about what the Siloviki are spending their money on.
I'll say a few things. I think we're only just starting at the start of the learning curve of what we can do with internet activism. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you about a couple of initiatives which I'm just fascinated to know whether they'll work, but I like the way they're at least conceptualizing the problem. So one of them is actually inspired by some sort of Californian phenomenon, but it's being put into a Russian context. So it's actually, what they've done is, let's say you have a question on the internet. Let's say, I don't know, it can be anything. Why is the sky blue? Or how does the oil price influence the ruble? Or anything you find interesting. You go to this place, and then they will very quickly select experts, because they have a pool of experts who will give you an answer. So what they're trying to do is stimulate you away from the Kremlin news into a space where you can get real answers. I think that's brilliant, because that actually, cause the genius of the internet is engagement. You know, that's why Mashable works a lot or whatever. It's all about how do we, because the whole myth busting stuff, it's really necessary. It inspires people by proxy to think critically, but you'll never, in the age of the internet, to do myth busting is absurd. I mean, you're always going to be 10 steps behind. So it's great what myth busting organizations do, but it's really the infantry work. It really can't be the main strategy. So it's about changing patterns of behavior. Another one is Aave, which is Against Violent Extremism. Which is nothing to do with Russia at the moment, but I'd love to spread it into Russia. So that's Google Ideas and the Weidenfeld Institute. And there they take people who are former extremists, skinheads, they're focused mainly on Islamic extremism. And they literally, they act like social workers online, they literally go inside into these forums, into these discussion groups, and try to change people's behavior. So those are two things that I've heard of. Are they the future? I don't know, but it's certainly very exciting. But it has to be based on engagement rather than just giving information, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's a long journey, and it needs a lot of funding and grassroots stuff. Do you know any organizations who do that?
Part of it too is, I think, educating journalists and people who cover these issues on how to avoid being duped or manipulated or exploited. So in our report, we sort of have a slate of recommendations, one of which is maybe it's worthwhile having a disinformation ombudsman for major news organizations. I mean, and not just focused on Russia, by the way. I mean, you could do this with respect to Egypt, Syria, Iran, other authoritarian regimes. When there is a story that doesn't smell right and you suspect it's been cooked up for the purposes of trying to sway public opinion in the West, investigating that full bore. I mean, the Lukashevich thing, for instance, that you didn't even need a specialism in Russia to figure out. You just needed common sense, right? Knowing the difference between time zones. A little more rigor and a little more care with which what they call the editorial framing of even news stories are packaged can go a long way. Now, people say, well, this, one of the criticisms I've had about this is, well, we don't like that. That's trying to control the press. Well, no, not really, because if your press standards are based on your, ability and the speed with which you arrive at the truth, then this is in your interest to do this. I mean, nobody's coercing you to do it, but you should just do it, for your own sake. So these are things that can be done. During the Cold War, there actually was a governmental effort to go around, sort of a pedagogical campaign to instruct and teach journalists and academics and intellectuals about the dirty tricks of the KGB. I don't think we have to go that far, because the one thing about most of the Putinist propaganda is a lot of it's so crude and it's so easily debunked. It's just about understanding that when they say Sukhoi 27 jets shot down MH17, you know, you can go to Wikipedia and figure out the altitude ceiling of the Sukhoi 27 fighter jet compared to where MH17 was in the sky, and all of a sudden put the brakes on running a story that says, you know, Russian general staff claims this was no. I mean, Russian general staff doesn't know the laws of aerodynamics. That's the story.
Can I ask one thing, Michael? I saw a documentary a couple of years ago about Lee Atwater, who was the great political technologist. We don't use that term here, but for the Republican Party, and he was George Bush Sr.'s, George 41's, main political strategist during the 1988 campaign. And there was a famous incident in the 1988 campaign, the so-called Willie Horton story, that Lee Atwater helped propagate. And it seemed as if in that, and it was full of lies, riddled with fallacy. But it seemed as if that was the first actual political race in the U.S. in which it was possible to spew out and out lies. There had been so much venom and nastiness in political campaigns before that, to be sure, from John Adams down. But this was the first time when you could actually say something that was just a wholesale falsehood and get away with it. You know what I mean? Grover Cleveland did have an illegitimate kid. Right, it was real. He was impugned in 1892 for it, but it was true. But in this case, it seemed as if American, and I apologize, it seems like a tangent, I'm going to get back on track, but it seemed like that after 88, and we experience this in political elections now all the time, it's just pure, unadulterated lies. They're lies. Now, I'm not saying that these lies, if we have some sort of, you know, prevarication meter, these lies rise to some of the falsehoods being spewed in Russia today, but they're sort of still, you know, lies nonetheless, you know, and sort of contending with that reality. I agree with Peter's point that we're always going to be 10 steps behind. You know, who's the guy, David Brock, who runs, what is his website called?
Media Matters.
Media Matters. Does that website have any impact or influence whatsoever on public debate in terms of writing alleged falsehoods?
Yeah, this is exactly the problem with the myth-busting stuff, is that it becomes just part of the partisanship. Very quickly, they're like, oh, that's a right-wing site myth-busting against the New York Times. Here's a left-wing site.
Yeah, I mean, in Brock's case, he is the Lee Atwater for Hillary's campaign in next year. So,
well, we have an idea how to maybe start talking about that. I think there's two things that could be done, maybe. I mean, to return to a reality-based conversation where we can at least agree on the facts before we start debating them.
That's Habermas. I don't think that will ever be possible in our lifetimes. The idea of a fact-based reality, it's not possible anymore. How do you return to that?
By seeing the consequences of not having one.
You know, a lot of this too is just it's the effect or the hangover of democratic society in a state of crisis. 2008, you had this enormous economic blow, not seen since the late 20s, early 30s. You know, America is extricating itself from two wars in the Middle East while starting three new ones. You know, we're in a state of discombobulation. And that is, if you like, the soil in which Putinism, I think, kind of takes root. He understands it. He sees America's sort of shabbiness, its eagerness to, I mean, we don't have political technologists. Instead, we call them directors of strategic communications, right, in the White House. It's the same thing. They're not as good as Surkov, but, you know, they do the same, they serve the same function. And they tell lies. They tell porkies, or they tell, you know, half-truths. You know, so, yeah, I mean, I would like, in an ideal world, I would like my government to sort of get up and say, this is what happened, and here's how we know it. Now you go discuss. It's not going to happen, though. I mean, so long as politics is politics. I think, you know, Peter's right. When the interpreter does its debunking of things, nobody ever assails us for the, you know, empirical shoddiness. Nobody can say, you got your facts wrong. Instead, it's, well, Khodorkovsky, or, oh, it's Weiss, you know, neocon CIA, or all this kind of crap. And, you know, we have an impact, we have an effect when it comes to people who I think can see past all that craziness and just, they're interested in the truth. But when it comes to changing the debate, whole scale or large scale rather, I don't see it having a measurable impact.
I think there's two things that we come up with. And one of the things that we suggest in the paper, and it might be a pipe dream.
By the way, this paper is linked to on the invitation to this event. So for those of you who want to read it, it will stay up there.
Which was having like a trans... There's two things, and they go together. One is developing a new glossary for propaganda, because something that I came across, we both came across as we researched the paper, was that there's this thing... Everything's propaganda. We were talking in Cambridge, as in like the best university in the world. There's PhD students that said, well, what's the difference between a shampoo ad and what the Kremlin does? It's all the formation of men's attitudes. And I just put my heads in my hands and wanted to cry. And Yevgen Fetchenko from Stopfake said, well, you know, when the Houthis and Tutsis are killing each other, you know, that was propaganda. Nobody's died from shampoo stuff. But even more simple than that, I think we need a new glossary going from misinformation, disinformation, public diplomacy, all the way through to, you know, facts. So that we actually have a much more critical way. So actually media education in schools, universities, very important. Anna Kachkaeva, who's the best sort of media thinker in Russia, is very, very big on this, and she has a whole system of her approaches. So it does actually have to go that deep. If we're going to face a deluge of disinformation in the 21st century, if the great challenge of the 21st century is going to be the abuse of freedom of information as opposed to censorship, then we really have to start changing behaviour at a very early and fundamental level so everyone becomes their own editor. So everyone starts thinking more critically. But and also,
you know what's the best malaprop in this paper? And I don't know, and it was certainly not deliberate, but you spelled Masha Littman's name like Walter Littman.
That's a lovely slip. That's perfect.
Walter Littman, for those of you who don't know, is a very famous American journalist for many years at the New York Times. Some people think is like the godfather of American journalism, but spelled his name with two P's and two N's, unlike Masha Littman, who's a Russian journalist who spells her name with one. It's fantastic, actually. By the way, what happened? There are no acknowledgments in your paper. I spent so much time with you on the phone.
You spent so much time.
At one point, I spoke with you from my home at 6 in the morning. Where are the acknowledgments? I was looking for
them.
You don't
want to cause harm to anybody by thanking them.
So let's take other questions. Is there anybody on the phone? I apologize, haven't gone. Who wants to ask anything? Please.
I have a question to Rabab. I was just wondering if you can elaborate further about the point where you said that the sort of independent media outlets in Egypt have a limited role in changing the state discourse. I think that these media outlets, they play an important role in the sense they provide information that otherwise is not available. And I think that this summer we saw a very powerful example where the mainstream media in Egypt were forced to report on the hunger strike, not because they wanted to do so, but because there was a growing online presence where bloggers, independent journalists, as well as like independent media outlets, they were reporting on the issue. So it kind of, you know, forced the mainstream media to report on this. So I just wanted to hear
what I was saying with it is that within the mainstream media, the big establishments, there's no difference between the public and the private. So the idea that, you know, something, this is, you know, on TV, for example, or Al-Haya, which is owned by business, independent, supposedly, businessmen, versus the national TV owned by the state, that makes no difference in terms of the kind of discourse they put forward that's anti-revolution, that's pro-Sisi, so on and so forth. What you're talking about in terms are what I think of as small islands within the alternative channels, particularly social media. So within the printed journals, for example, newspapers or TV, we don't have anything alternative. Within internet sphere, of course, we have that, and that has been one of the amazing things about the internet. But again, to what extent does this affect the mainstream discourse? That is something that I see clearly. It's very marginal, because the mainstream discourse doesn't have to agree on everything, right? Even those disagreements that I mentioned between state institutions, right? There are more, there are pro-Sisi versus the pro-Shafiq people, Shafiq being also a Mubarak man who had run for elections and stood the runoff with Morsi. So you see those differences, right? Accordingly, you see those voices reporting on the hunger strike or those who are in jail or the 6th of April. But then how does this get translated everything becomes lost in that translation when it comes to the mainstream media. So within the mainstream media, the story becomes that those people just want to tarnish the reputation of Egypt, that they're doing this because they're being funded by the U.S. That, no, of course, look at this. They're eating, behind cameras. Look how fat he is. So those kinds of things. So yes, it's reported, but what kind of reporting?
Alex Clement, perhaps the only person at the table, speaks both Arabic and Russian. Ah. Anything you want to share, Alex? We have a few minutes left.
I mean, I just actually was struck most by what Michael said about how a lot of this has to do with the responsibility of journalists themselves, right? I mean, there's a lot of talk about traditional media sort of being under fire. It's not profitable anymore. Where do we go for money? You know, two of the best organizations that have done reporting on Ukraine have been BuzzFeed and Vice, right? Like, that's an interesting, kind of dynamic. But I think this question of, what further responsibilities are incumbent upon journalists sort of as foot soldiers in this information war, whatever we call it, I think is an important one. And I think also, that there's a higher responsibility placed on governments themselves to be more transparent and accountable, right? I mean, the reason, as you said, the reason Podemos and Syriza and all these, or the far right on the other hand, the reason these exist is because of a crisis of faith in their own governments. And here we are in the U.S. 2 days after this horrendous torture report has come out, which is a victory for transparency, but is a tremendous condemnation of U.S. policy. And I think those, so both on the journalistic side and on the government side, because I think that's what we're really talking about. The targets of the Russian strategy are journalists and governments. And so the responsibility is to not treat those like victims, but actually actors in this.
And, by the way, what happens in 25 years when Putin is out of power and there's been some kind of cataclysm in Russia and state secrets start to emerge and then, U.S. intelligence becomes declassified and we find out all the kind of dirty shit that our government has been sitting on about what Putin has been up to. I mean, we were in Europe about a month ago, and heard it from somebody who was in a position to say these things, that apparently there's a phone call between Putin and Poroshenko in which Putin tells Poroshenko to go shoot more people dead in the streets of Kiev.
Yanukovych.
I'm sorry, Yanukovych, yeah, good.
That would be amazing.
Rewind, yeah. Sorry. Whoops. That's really amazing. Whoops. Not really a Freudian slip, but anyway. Yes, with Yanukovych. And, this it was intercepted by Signals Intelligence, and it's sort of an open secret among the various, government apparatuses throughout the world now. Well, if the KGB can upload conversations between Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt, or the Estonian foreign minister and the EU high representative allegedly embarrassing Western policy with respect to Ukraine, wouldn't that change the conversation, like, forever? If the president of Russia is telling the president of Ukraine to shoot more people dead in the streets? And yet we're sitting on it because, and my supposition is, I think, somewhat validated by what I said about this sort of CIA journalist confab, they don't want to change the regime in Russia. They don't want to see Putin out of power. They want to keep his secrets for him, and he knows it, which allows him, I think, a greater impunity to carry on.
But what about Edward Snowden? We don't know what Putin is sitting on that.
Absolutely.
So we could come out with something, and he could, body slam.
Absolutely.
Even in this context,
you think Putin controls Snowden?
Well, he's probably sitting on all those secrets.
But we haven't even addressed and we're not in a tripod anymore. This is like sort of a centipede holding something up. But another leg, which is the journalists can validate their information by going to academics, but nobody's tracking the academics and the influence that they get from Russia. And that's never talked about or exposed, and it's incredibly pervasive. So the journalists can't actually find a way to get someone else to validate their information.
And so much, my other thing in life is Syria. And so much of the reporting on Syria in the early days of the revolution was just garbage because people, the construct was, Assad is a reformist. That was the U.S. policy position, too, for a long time. Assad is reformist. No, he'll never be overthrown. No, he'll never do what his father did in Hama. No, he'll never use chemical weapons. People are loyal to the regime, blah, 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 blah. How much of that has been just turned into toilet paper over the last 4 years? Yeah? And it's because people were going to, I don't want to name too many names, but, sort of the established figures and the self-appointed sort of, you know, gray eminences of Syriology who were essentially telling them this. And they just took it as gospel truth at face value without investigating or trying to do any digging themselves. You know, the completely polar opposite line from that is the Tom Friedman approach, where you ask a cab driver, explain to me how things work in this country, right? I'm not saying do that, but, you know, a little bit of shoe leather journalism. And you're quite right. The crisis in media and journalism today, you know, I think I said it, it's either in the report or I've said it publicly. If the New York Times doesn't have the money to send people to Cyprus or the British Virgin Islands or the Dutch Antilles, which is where the Russian oligarchy likes to register its offshore companies and where they do a lot of their money laundering, then you know what? BuzzFeed does have the money to do it. They can do it. Mashable probably has the money to do it. Vice has the money to do it. You know, offshore, Putin talks about the offshorization of you know, or the de-offshorization of Russian wealth, bringing it all back into the country. We should be offshoreizing journalism, because all Russian wealth is still stationed outside of Russia. Again, put the focus on what the real story is. This is a, you know, you said, Cece, it's like a mafia, virtual mafia state. This is one of the most poetically and precise terms invented for Putinism. Came from the U.S. State Department. We know what's going on. We just don't want to say it publicly.
Question I put on the line for Peter about the idea of alternative Russian language television. How would you propose to get this before a mass audience in any country farther east than Ukraine, where the governments are going to do everything possible to keep it away from mass audiences?
Well, I mean, we have to split up our audiences. So, I mean, the main actually target is west of Ukraine. So it's the Russians in Ukraine, in Latvia, Estonia, Germany, Moldova. So those are that's actually the swing sort of demographic that we really have to be focused on first and foremost. Inside of Russia, it's
except for Ukraine, you're talking about tiny groups of people and huge investments.
Well, are they that huge? I mean, this is I'm actually doing meeting after meeting at the moment, trying to evaluate which is the best way to go. So, do you form a production company that creates programs for existing channels? How is 4.5 million in Germany a small amount of people? But can we pool resources? So, news from Dozhd, you know, stuff being done in Moldova to create one channel. So, this is the discussion that's happening. How exactly do you structure that approach to make it contemporary?
How's the new website doing in Riga?
Which one?
Medusa?
Yeah, really. I mean, I don't know what their numbers are like, but it's up and running. So, this is a series of conversations that's happening now. I know one of the endowments for democracy is about to do a feasibility study, which I'll be involved in. So, I'll tell you in 3 months' time when we're done.
Okay. Jeff.
I just wonder, because most
Jeff,
people,
quickly.
Yeah, just to the point, I mean, you pointed out how good Russian television is now from the entertainment point of view, and I wonder whether a news-only format is really going to be applicable.
No, I don't think that at all, and I've been arguing in meetings about this, about what the programming strategy and priorities might be. I think news is a sine qua non, but so not the main problem. Especially if we're talking about, people do actually have sources of information. This is not true. They're being emotionally captured, emotionally manipulated, and that's where the great conversation has to be. So no, I completely agree. I think news is something that has to be done, especially local news, because that I think is very important to people, like somebody in Narva is hearing about their own lives. But no, the main that's not going to save the situation at all. I make it reality shows, so my focus is on something completely different.
Okay, so Peter, Michael, and Rabab, this has been amazingly stimulating. Thank you so much for coming in. I will say Peter's book again.
Yeah, keep them coming.
Nothing's true, everything's possible. It's the holiday season.
It's just been chosen by GQ as one of its recommended book gifts. But maybe for you guys, very nice reviews of it in the Journal this week and in Tablet. That seems to be all the crew here. He's
Tablet.
Handling. Yeah.
And good luck to Michael, who's finishing a book on ISIS this Monday. You're handing in the manuscript?
Inshallah, yeah.
So thank you for coming out at the 11th hour, Michael.
Cheers.
And thank you all very much.